talk about that complex psychological relationship we have with animals. We'll get back to that conversation about some we love, some we hate, some we eat. Hal Herzog in just a minute on Coast to Coast. Coming up at the bottom of the hour then, about 20 minutes from now, we'll line up some of your calls for Hal Herzog, and we'll continue the conversation that way. That'll transition us into open lines for the rest of the night. And we'll throw in there a quick conversation coming up about an hour from now with James Childs. Now, you know, James Childs has been tracking disasters for years. His book, Flirting with Disaster, terrific book. Or is it Inviting Disaster? Suddenly I can't remember. But you know what I'm talking about. The book in which he goes through on why the planets lined up wrong for certain events. What was it, technologically speaking, which led to these breakdowns of some of our biggest disasters? And he's also written about helicopters and other technological things. But he's been looking at this Chilean mine shaft problem. And we're going to talk to him about that because the breakthrough happened, right? These miners in Chile, they have there's a hole now. And there's a decision to be made on whether they're going to line the hole and secure the hole, even though it'll take longer in order to get them out, or do you just start taking them out now? And then in what order do you take them out? That's just another question. In case there's another cave-in, who should be last? And then we'll get to open lines and just any topic you want to coming up. And you might want to continue this conversation about animals. But also coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, it's Holy Ghosts, how a not-so-good Catholic boy became a believer in things that go bump in the night. He lives here in the New York metropolitan area in a house that he had grown up in, a house that his mother always said was haunted, a claim he always dismissed until he moved back as an adult. And he'll talk about the things he experienced. That's coming up tomorrow night. And then on the back end of that conversation, the book Field of Screams, a great baseball book about ghosts. And more of that coming up tomorrow on Coast to Coast. But first, why do we hate the ones we hate? Why don't we eat the ones that we hate of the animals that are out there? I think I have another theory why. We'll run it past Hal Herzog next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking with Hal Herzog, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. This is a terrific book, very well written, great series of chapters, all kind of short, thought-provoking studies. This is like a year's worth of dinner conversations. Although you might not want to have them before you eat certain things. You might want to like wait after dinner conversations, maybe. So here's a theory I was kicking around, and maybe it's because I haven't finished the book yet. Maybe you address this. On why we love some and hate others. This may even sound very rudimentary, so pardon me. It's probably a freshman 101 observation. But that the animals that we hate in our culture are the ones which seem to represent the worst of us. And the ones that we love, aspirationally, we think represents the best of us. And so by loving the ones that we love, we think better about ourselves. For hating the ones we hate, we have the sort of Jungian shadow self reaction where we're hooked by the thing that we're most like. And we're more like snakes maybe than we are like puppies. You know what I mean?
Huh, that's an interesting idea. I've never thought of it that way. So for example, we think of dogs as being loyal. So we like dogs because they're loyal to us.
Right. And we think of ourselves as loyal. We want to be.
We dislike rats because they eat garbage.
Well, we dislike rats because they're sneaky, because they hide, because they don't seemingly they sort of seem dishonest.
Okay, let me throw this at you.
Okay.
That it works the other. Now I'm going to throw this idea out too. This is just another idea that we think of rats as sneaky. Not because they are sneaky, but because we don't like them.
Okay, but
for example, some people really like rats. I know people that keep rats for pets, and they say they're loyal and all that. And
sure.
And all that stuff.
Well, and I know people that keep snakes as pets, but I think that there's I don't have any problem with snakes, but I think one of the reasons why we look at snakes the way we do is because we can't trust them. And we think of snakes as having these negative characteristics, these negative qualities, whereas they're just surviving like any other species, right? I mean, they're just doing what they're put on.
Yeah, but see, I know snakes really well because I studied them for years.
Sure.
And I trust snakes more than I do dogs. I can predict the snake's behavior better than I can predict a strange dog's behavior.
No, and that actually oddly makes my point. I think that speaks to our unfamiliarity with snakes.
Yes.
But that's what we think of snakes.
Absolutely. I agree with that completely. Yes.
Right. And snakes, you know, because they don't they don't change their expression, because snakes don't reflect anything back to us at all.
Well, the other thing, though, is that the animals that we love and hate can shift very quickly. So, for example, my brother-in-law loved deer until he put in a garden. And all of a sudden, deer went from being these cute things like Bambi to things that he absolutely despises.
Right.
You see this over and over again. A friend of mine, Arnie Arluck, an anthozoologist from Northeastern University, he's just written a book looking at animals through picture postcards. And he's got this book, and he shows these wolf roundups. From back in Kansas, let's say, around the 1920s. And it's just horrifying. What you see is these giant piles of wolf carcasses, and there was a bounty on these. And we have now made these animals, we've made wolves noble. So killer whales are the same thing. At one time, they're killer whales. Now they're orcas.
Right.
So one of the things is that culture can make an enormous impact on the animals
okay.
we love and hate.
But all right, then let me also I'll push you a little bit further on that.
Sure.
What if the reason why we experience these shifts is because we see ourselves in an animal that now gains favor, like, you know, a lot of the shift in the whole story of orcas happens around Free Willy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Totally
so
right.
How do we identify with this? Well, suddenly. They're an underdog species, and we relate to them because we think, oh, but that's just like me. I feel trapped too. I'm living in this trapped life. I want to be out in the open ocean. Oh, help us get, you know, by freeing Willie, we free ourselves.
I think you're really onto something. And one of the things about anthrozoology is that we're a pretty new field. We're a very new field. And I think that that's exactly the kind of ideas that we need. And those are the kind of innovative ideas that sort of do to me what you're doing to me is what I want my book to do to other people. I want them to think about things a little differently. And
well,
so you're running these ideas by me, and I'm saying, like, my initial impression is like, nah. And then I think about thinking like, yeah.
Well, that's what the book definitely does. It pushes everybody. Some we love, some we hate, some we eat. It's all about our complex relationship with animals. Right. So why do we eat the ones we eat? What is the prevailing consistency to the logic of why we have, you know, a select group of animals that we eat in our, say, just in our Western culture generally?
It's a very small group of animals, too.
Yeah.
And Jared Diamond, basically, he looks at all the mammals, all the animals that we could eat. And he says it basically boils down to about 14. And part of it makes sense. Part of these are herd animals that are easy to take care of, that, you know, eat grass and stuff like that. But part of it just seems ridiculously arbitrary. And one of the things that I think I've learned about in our relationships with animals generally is just how absolutely arbitrary and almost faddish it can be. So, for example, take raw fish. You know, yeah, I grew up in an era where in the United States where the idea of eating raw fish would be disgusting.
Laughable. I mean, you'd
laughable.
Be an idiot. Right.
Absolutely. And now they're a delicacy. Even my little town has just had a new sushi place open up.
How about that? In Western North Carolina.
Yep.
How about that? Yeah. And you know, I'll just make the point. The same thing about, you know, what they used to call frou-frou coffee and lattes.
Absolutely.
And cappuccinos, and now you go through McDonald's.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Let me mention one other thing, by the way, about food. We may bring this up, but I think one of the great paradoxes of our relationships with animals over the last, let's say, 20 and 30 years is that the more we love animals, the more people say that they love animals, which you mentioned, the more we bring them into our family, the more we love to eat them. And we now eat three times as many animals each year in the United States as we did when Peter Singer wrote Animal Liberation. Mm-hmm. And our consumption of meat has gone up per capita from about 170 pounds a person to 240 pounds a person. So the weird thing about, for all our saying that we care about animals so much, what we really love to do is eat them more than any other time in American history.
Well, and at what point, though, do we say, thank you, Dr. Atkins, for that?
I think Dr. Atkins probably played a big role in that. I think the other thing that played a role in that in terms of the animal protection movement and also the government, as beef sort of got vilified, what people did was they more than made up for it in chicken. So between the 1970s and the present, our consumption of beef went down 20%. Our consumption of chicken went up 200%.
Right. You know, I love the, especially when it comes to things like chicken and beef. You live in Western North Carolina, so there's probably a lot of Chick-fil-A's around there.
Right.
So, but not everywhere in the country has a Chick-fil-A, but the national campaign for Chick-fil-A has always been eat more chicken, and it's supposedly a campaign that's being held by cows.
I know.
Right. So but I think we love that. We love when animals tell us to eat them.
It is so true. I'm glad you're the only one that can sort of pick that up. That's exactly what's happened. It's been successful. The cows have plotted to make us eat more chicken. And it's been an incredibly successful campaign in a way.
Yeah, there was even when I was in Chicago, there used to be something called, I think, the Calumet City Meat Company or something like that. And their mascot was a dancing pig that was basically taunting the audience to eat him. And I always thought, God, that's so permissive. And at the same time, it also spoke to some sort of innate, maybe tribal need to conquer over a species, and especially an obnoxious one like a pig that's dying to be eaten. Why, we must go eat that pig. I mean, it was sort of this weird reaction, and I think that kind of ad campaign goes on all the time, and it seems entirely intended to put away any prohibition you might have against eating an animal, because it's okay to eat the animal if the animal says it's okay, right? I mean, then it's not
That's
wrong.
That's right, yeah. Well, the other point you're making about conquering a species I really like, and if you look at any species we've conquered, I think it's the dog. If you go to an American Kennel Club dog show, and you can see what we have done to the basic wolf. When I say conquered, I don't mean the dog, I mean really the wolf. You know, when we domesticated the wolf, we've created these animals that just are absolutely extraordinary. You know, an animal that is an adult weighs 3 pounds, and an animal in the same species that weighs 300 pounds as an adult. The difference between my size and that of a bull elephant. And we have done that. And there's actually a theory of pets which is very much like what you said. It basically says what pet keeping is a form of domination.
Right. I can still see that. But even about that shift in the wolf perception, at a time, especially on the prairie, wolves must have represented to the average person, say, living in Kansas, it probably was the poster animal for chaos. That you can have your whole world ordered, you can have all the chickens, you can be taking care of yourself, but those wolves were going to come in and they were going to ruin everything. And then at some point later on, maybe sometime around the gas shortage or something, where we're feeling like, oh my God, the world is changing. Suddenly the nobility of wolves, their independence, their sense of survival, that's what we identify with.
Yes.
And they're no longer a threat to us anyway, but we've essentially mollified the threat.
Yes.
But now we can see them in a more positive light.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
But yet we, you know, again, we don't eat wolves. No one ever ate wolves, even when we hated them. Nobody ate them. You know, it wasn't like anybody was stringing them up.
There's some people that argue that we did eat wolves, and that's in part how they became domesticated.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. The idea that, you know, we let these, you know, that we let dogs, you know, sort of wolves sort of hang around closer and closer to us. We let them scavenge, and then every now and then, when times got hard, we would cook their puppies.
Hal Herzog's the author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. Why do you think the Japanese eat literally anything?
I'm not sure they eat literally. They certainly eat things that we don't eat, and they eat a lot of things. And the most interesting thing they eat, by the way, I think is fugu. You know what fugu is?
It doesn't sound good, but...
Well, what it is, no, it's more than not sounding good. It's a form of puffer fish that is deadly poison.
Right.
If you get the right amount, you get this little buzz on your tongue. If you get a little too much, you die.
Right. Yeah, I remember the Simpsons episode. So they have like a registered number of people who can actually cut fugu.
That's exactly right. But yeah, okay. My daughter was in Japan, and she ate whale. They served whale at the school that she taught at.
Yeah, but you look at when Andrew Zimmern was doing, you know, bizarre foods in Japan, that wasn't even a challenge. I mean, because it was the things they would serve, like, and it was almost like a kind of sport eating, like, you know, eyeball and other stuff that they were. It was like this big, giant, drunken dare in Japan. It seemed like all these foods that they would sell on a street were intended to be, to have with them a kind of bragging rights to them. Almost like, you've eaten that? Yeah, I've eaten that. But have you eaten this? And there seemed to be an element to that. And I wondered how that was reflected in their culture, generally speaking, about where they saw themselves, you know, in the world order or something.
But... Yeah, I'm not sure. They have one of the things about Japan that I've noticed is that they like small things in some ways. And so, for example, I remember seeing some handheld fireworks in Japan one time, believe it or not. but right now in Japan, there's a fad for insects as pets.
Right.
Fireflies, they're called mushi. Beetles, and the little Japanese kids, instead of having cockfighting and dogfighting, what they'll have is stag fighting. They actually can go on YouTube, and you can look at beetle fights in Japan.
But in that same way, too, on just on an average street corner, they can have, you know, beetle barbecues, and they're serving, like, a big scarab on a stick, you know, deep-fried.
Yeah, that's not just in Japan. You see the same thing in Thailand. You see the same thing in China. They have broader eating habits.
What won't they eat? Do you know by any chance? I mean, I know I'm asking you slightly outside of your expertise, perhaps, but what won't they eat, say, in Asia?
Yeah, I'm not really qualified to deal with that. I reference an old book in my book, which I've unfortunately forgotten the name of the book, but it was written by this Danish guy in about 1880s, the deliciousness of various foods. And he chronicles various food ways in different countries, and we're talking things like elephant toes and egret tongues and flamingo tongues and things like that.
Right.
And it's just you know, people at some point have eaten virtually every part of every animal.
And at times like that, it seemed, when there was that movement that you mentioned, like egret tongues, it seemed, again, to be almost an expression of power and dominion, a kind of, this is how precious I am, that I can have this one little piece and have it served up in such quantities that it would satiate me, you know?
Yeah, and part of that's availability. If you go back, far enough in human, the history of our species, you know, my guess is that if you go back to Africa 100,000 years ago, that people were eating what was available to them and eating lots of it, as much as
they could. But that's interesting. But I would think there's also some element to the nobility, that the nobility felt like they couldn't eat the same things that the common person ate.
That's certainly true. And if there's one principle about social class and food, is that the richer people get, the more they want meat.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. Maybe that's proteins, though, to feed their brain. They feel the need to stay where they are. Well, so wherever you see something on this you want to latch onto, we'd love to have you. Get about a half hour of the phone calls with Hal Herzog, and then we'll go open lines after that. We'll spend a little time talking about what's happening as we speak down in Chile. But some we love, some we hate, some we eat. The complex psychological relationship we have with animals. Where are you with all of that? We'll give you the numbers next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. This means it's your chance to jump into the conversation. Some we love, some we hate, some we eat. Hal Herzog takes your calls the next half hour. Also coming up on Coast to Coast, tomorrow night we'll talk about the Holy Ghost, so to speak, the one that was haunting the house of one of the religion editors for Doubleday Books. And then we'll talk about Field of Screams, This book that chronicles ghosts in baseball. We've talked about rock and roll history when it comes to, you know, things that go bump in the night. Well, what about baseball and the things that have been haunting ballparks, ball players? Who's done it? Who's still lurking out there? Who's been seen at major ballparks all across the country? That sort of thing. We'll talk about that coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. Should be big fun. Hal Herzog coming up next takes your calls on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So some we love, some we hate, some we eat, but we'll take every caller. And let's go east of the Rockies. We'll start with Grayson in Michigan for Hal Herzog. Grayson?
Hi. We haven't really discussed leather tonight and human use of leather. And, of course, fur is much more a controversial subject, but just wanted to ask if he talked about leather at all in the book.
Yeah, how come some we wear would be a whole other chapter, right? Hal?
Weather, huh? I don't really... The main thing with weather, actually...
No, leather.
Oh, leather. I'm sorry. I think it's leather. That really is a subsidiary of the food industry. And one of the things that's been most interesting to me in terms of the response to my book is the number of people that have come up to me and they have told me that they're vegetarians and in some cases vegan, and they feel really guilty because they still wear leather. And I remember a woman came up to me at a conference recently and said, you know, I'm a vegan, but I have these lovely red shoes that she actually had them on, and she said, you know, I just can't give them up. And she really felt torn about that. And I remember I interviewed an animal activist one time whose real passion was playing church league softball, and he was giving it up because he could find a glove that was made out of plastic, but he couldn't find a decent ball that was. And so I think that the leather is actually a big issue for some people. Some places sort of more difficult than
right. But you know what? If I jump in there and say that there's on the question of leather and fur, there seems to be some of the same kind of contradictions that you talk about in the book in terms of what we eat and what we hate and what we like. That we will wear furs, we will adorn ourselves. I say we, meaning many people will, with animal that they would never eat. So it's one thing to say
that's absolutely true.
So that's kind of an odd contradiction.
A lot of the high end furs are animals that are predators. You know, mink, foxes, things like that. That's
right.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, we would never eat fox meat, and the fur industry, much like perhaps even some of the leather industry, it really isn't a byproduct in some cases of the food industry. It seemed to be a very specific thing. For example, a lot more people wear crocodile than eat crocodile.
That's absolutely true. And where you really see that is the controversy over baby seals.
Well, not for me, because, you know, I find the whole seal thing is really, that's one of those clear-cut cases for me, one way or another. Eating or wearing, couldn't do it.
Right. But the thing about the baby, one of the things that's interesting about the baby seal, the seal harvest, is that the Canadian government sort of succumbed to world pressure on that, and these baby seals, they're absolutely adorable when they're first born. They're white with these pools for eyes, but as they age, they get less cute because they get darker. And what the Canadian government did a number of years ago is they banned the harvest, the clubbing of these baby seals when they were in the white coat stage, but they still permitted it when they're in the dark coat stage. So they banned the baby seal hunt, but really what they banned was the cute baby seal hunt.
You know, you mentioned the doll's eyes, you know, that these babies, which really are big black eyes.
Yeah.
They're kind of the same eyes you see on a shark, but we see those eyes very different. We see
Absolutely.
Them as cold and indifferent on a shark. Yeah.
Yeah, they sure do look different. Yeah.
West of the Rockies, JP is in Livingston, Montana on Coast to Coast for Hal Herzog. JP?
How you doing, Ian?
Couldn't be better. Thank you.
One thing I haven't heard yet is how some of us take our pets as our soulmates.
Explain.
Like, well, I've got a part coyote and a part black lab dog that I've had for 6 years. I communicate with her and understand her more than anybody else I've ever come across, even some of my girlfriends. Put a joke
right
in there.
No. I mean, you're not alone in that. I mean, and there's some very interesting experiments on that too. So what's ultimately, though, other than the fact that you and this dog communicate and you feel like you have a real connection, what are there any contradictions? I mean, would you shoot another coyote that's coming across your property? Would you, I mean,
no.
Does it present any other problem for you that you love this dog so much?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. Let me say something about that. My friend, Tricia McConnell, who studies dogs a lot, she's written some great books on this. She talks about a dog for life, that sometimes you'll find a dog for life. And that's the animal that's going to be always the most important animal that you're ever going to have. And it really can be more important than any person in your life. And in her recent book, she talks about the dog for life for her, and actually discusses in some ways that, you know, how her husband sort of had to deal with the fact that she had this dog in her life. And I interviewed a guy for my book that felt the same way about this German Shepherd mix that he had. And he told me, he said, I love that dog more than any person I've ever loved in my life. And I think those relationships are very real. They're very, very deep. They don't come along very often in a person's life.
But speak
real,
to that.
It's for real, man.
Yeah, that story you tell, though, about the family that kept dogs for hunting and then also kept dogs in the house, and they were totally two different relationships.
Oh, yeah, that's my friend Sammy Hensley and his wife Betty. Yeah, Sammy had these hunting dogs. I'd go coon hunting with him sometime. And those dogs, you know, he really liked those dogs, but they basically, I wouldn't want to be one of his hounds, because they basically spent most of their life tied to an 8-foot leash. And then he'd let them, you know, a lead, you know, tied to a doghouse. And then he'd let them out, you know, during hunting season. And then occasionally, but they were hunting dogs. They were never allowed in the house. But then they would have, they'd have a couple pet dogs usually that they were allowed in the house. They were allowed to eat at the table. And then when Sammy died in a tractor accident, you know, his wife, Betty Sue, she got rid of the hounds pretty quick. You know, she wasn't a coon hunter, but she kept this little Boston Terrier that just helped her out so much getting over the grief for the death of her husband. It was like two different species entirely.
Well, it kind of actually reminded me of the two different types of you know, the classes of slaves in the Old South.
Boy, that's a great point. And
house dogs and field dogs.
Yeah,
you know?
Man, that's a great point. And one of the, I think, you know, animal activism is of course controversial, but some of the arguments made by animal activists are actually very powerful. And I think one of their most powerful arguments is if you look at the language of slave ownership, and if you look at the language of how we exploit animals, there's a lot of similarity there. But you're making a really good point.
Let's grab Jeff in California, wildcard line for Hal Herzog. Some we love, some we hate, some we eat. Just a great read. Jeff, where are you on this?
Well, I am a casual fisherman. I fish like maybe two or three times over a course of 2 years. I've caught an albacore and seen him and looked at him and took him home and ate him. I've caught trout, and sometimes you catch a small one and you have to let it go, so you have empathy for the fish. So, like, you know, I can feel empathy for the animals. And one thing that came across my mind listening to you both talking was that we need to teach youngsters that, you know, these are animals, these are part of the food chain. And I see that lacking in the education system right now.
The farther we get away from the farm, the less people make any of that associations. Yeah, you say empathy, Jeff, but I'm going to challenge you on that and say ultimately letting go the little ones, that's in your self-interest, right, as
possibly,
a fisherman?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, we call that empathy.
The game rules.
Right. You don't want some DNR guy coming after you is really what it's about. But all right. So Hal Herzog, what would you say here to Jeff?
Well, I can definitely relate to that, because for a lot of years, I was a pretty serious fisherman, and I was primarily a mountain trout stream. I was a mountain stream trout fisherman. And that was a main passion in my life. And I would almost always let the fish go. And I don't do that anymore. And for a variety of reasons, but part of the reason is actually ethical. And I just didn't get the kick out anymore. And I would, especially when I caught a big fish and I would look at it, and I felt this great sense of pride in catching the fish. But on the other hand, there was a part of me that, like, do I really have the right to yank you out of the water and inflict this pain on you and put you back in the water, knowing that there's a 20, 30, 40% chance that you're going to die this slow death because I've hooked you for my personal pleasure.
Right.
And I still miss fishing some, but I don't have as much desire as I used to do it, that's for sure.
But could you eat? I mean, if you were just to do it less often, but every time you pulled it out of the water, you ate it, where would you be with that?
To me, that would not make any real difference at all. And a lot of people tell me, for example, they justify hunting because they say, well, they eat it. But I don't really buy that justification. I think there are some people that really do subsistence hunting now. My son has some friends that live in Montana, and they really, they really need to kill a moose to get through the winter. But right. Most people don't. Most people do it for recreational purposes, and they eat it basically not primarily. They eat it because they've killed it, not that they're killing it primarily because they eat it. I think. What? I know with Sammy, when Sammy and I would go coon hunting, he didn't eat those raccoons.
Okay, well, but I don't know. Part of me says recreational, yes, but also to a degree psychological. And yeah. there's something that may just, it's a deep inner itch that some people have.
It totally is, and I totally get that. And that's what I loved about fishing. I love the solitariness. I love the connection with the animal. I loved all that stuff. But that doesn't make it morally right.
Right.
And that's the problem. See, I love barbecue, but that doesn't make it morally right. To me, that's the big struggle. I love having a cat. I love living with a serial killer cat.
Right.
But that doesn't make it morally right that I happen for my pleasure to keep this animal in my life that goes out and wreaks havoc on all the little creatures that live around it. So I'm genuinely conflicted about these issues.
And maybe it's just that what we think of as being something which is easily understood morally is just ineffable.
And I think that to some degree is right, and that's one of the things I wanted to. What I argue in my book is that these contradictions, I don't call them hypocrisies anymore, because I think we all have to live with them, and it's part of what it makes us human. No other animal has to deal with these issues. A chimpanzee has no compunction at all about ripping the arm off a live coal of this monkey and eating it. But we have that moral burden that these other animals don't share.
You know, I'm conflicted by that because I practice catch and release hunting, where I'll shoot an animal, then I have a vet fix it up, and then I let it back out of the wild. Not many people do that.
You're the first.
It's really, that's what I do.
I love that.
So let's get to RJ in Nodak on Coast to Coast. RJ?
Greetings. Yes, my question or comment both is about I had a cat that I really took good care of, and then in the neighborhood there was this stray cat, and so I started feeding him a little bit, and now he's kind of a half of a family member, but I can't really keep him, so I move him to a friend's house across town, but I'm talking 4 miles across busy traffic in a place he's never been, because it's just a very young cat. But on the way to delivering him, trying to get him into my friend's house, he was so skittish because he was just a tomcat. You know, he jumped out of my arms and flew down the street, and I'm going, well, I guess you'll never see him again. You know, and I felt so bad. I felt terrible. But then not 3 days later, I hear this meow because I had a screen door. And I hear this meow on my porch, and I go out there, and the cat's standing there looking at me. And I'm going, how the heck did that cat find its way through all that busy traffic 3-4 miles away back to my little house over here? Didn't know. I've seen that movie Homeward Bound, where I guess, these animals have these
sure.
homing instincts. But what is a homing instinct. How do they know how to do that? Because I don't think humans can do that.
Yeah.
That's my question, I guess.
Yeah, okay. Any thought on that?
Well, yeah, well, a lot of animals have that instinct. At one point, I studied alligators in my early career, and there were some studies of alligators where they would capture alligators, move them 25 miles away in a swamp that all looks alike, and then a couple of weeks later, they'd be right back to where they started. Snakes do the same thing. Homing occurs in lots of animals, of course, homing pigeons and stuff like that. And there's a lot, you know, the classic example of that sort of thing would be sea turtles. And different animals use different mechanisms. Some animals use the Earth's magnetic field for that. Some animals can actually navigate with the stars, it's been shown. Perhaps smell in some cases. But that's a great story about the cat. Do you still have that cat?
And look, we still have that caller. I think we lost the caller. We have the cat, but we lost the caller. Let's go to Wynn.
Too bad. I'm curious, because my guess is he's stuck with that cat now. Any cat that's willing to go back to go through all that, go back to his house, he's not going to get in the car and take it away.
Oh, yeah. But like all callers, he'll make his way back to the phone someday.
Okay.
Wayne is in Louisiana on a wild card line. He knows a little bit about gators probably down there. Hey, Wayne.
Hey, Ian. How you doing? Hey, this is a very, very interesting subject matter. And two things. Well, two quick little things. Deep fried alligator on a stick is very good.
It is.
And did you know that domesticated cats and people are the only mammals on Earth that torture? I just wanted to make those comments. But look, I have a 11-pound Shih Tzu that would argue with you about us being a dominant species. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
I really have a lot of fun with that. I also have a little Chihuahua. But I am blind, and I have been for about 10 years or so. But my question to Hal, and I don't know if you cover this in your book, but I guess going on a behavior would be, I'm wondering if my dogs know that I'm blind. Sometimes I think that they
whether they know that you're blind. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
okay. Well, we have to get the answer real quick. Hal, what do you think of that? What do we? Any research on what animals can tell about our limitations?
Boy, you know, I shouldn't. I just don't know that. Certainly, if your dog was a seeing eye dog, it would know you're blind because they go through all kind of special training. But I'm just not sure. Were you blind when you got the dog?
Wayne?
Yes, I was.
You were blind when you got the dog.
Yeah, I'm going to make a guess on this. I would say probably no. I'd say your dogs probably don't know that you're blind.
I wonder whether, you know, in all of the research they've done in universities, whether somebody would ever do that. How long it would take for an animal to perceive our limitations?
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. There's one thing that we do know about dogs is that they know when you're not paying attention to them. And that would be the only thing. So, for example, if you tell your dog to do something and then you start watching television, your dog will monitor. There's recently been a good study on this. The dog will monitor, and when you're watching the television, the dog is more likely to disobey. So that might be the only context that I could think of where the dog might know you're blind. Might try and get around stuff.
I know that we only had 2 hours with you. Can I ask you to hang on for a few minutes just so we can give you a proper goodbye coming up? Can we do that? Hal Herzog, stand by. Just enough to say goodnight coming up next on Coast to Coast.